they are hell-bent on waging this uncontrolled war.
This write-in candidacy that I have here in the 3rd District is hopefully going to seriously register on the Democratic Party's radar.
President Bush was making his case for his position on Iraq, and he said forcefully, either Saddam Hussein disarms or we will.
Basically, we're looking at a warfare police state.
There's something wrong with this picture.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, October 22nd. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Today, people around the country came out to protest police brutality in a national day of action. As Deepa Fernandez reports from WBAI, activists calling for an end to police killings are joining forces with anti-war protesters as they see repression in communities of color at home intrinsically linked to the pending war on Iraq.
And Eddie was firing, and Sean came down, I looked inside the vestibule, and at that point I got this sick feeling in my stomach, because when I looked in, I seen who I now know to be Mr. Diallo just standing in the back, a little turn to his left with his arm pointed out, when I seen a gun in his hand.
Today, October 22nd, is a national day of action against police brutality.
So the question of war and repression go hand in hand. Because it's during times of war that the government seeks to have the acquiescence of the people.
Police and law enforcement killings of unarmed people around the country are on the rise. Steve Yip is with the October 22nd Coalition, who's organizing today's National Day of Action.
Trying to reintroduce and recapture the political stage on the question of police brutality and bring the links on the question of repression and bring the links and understanding of like the detentions taking place. We need to do that independently. We need to do that so that there is a firm identity around these particular issues. But secondarily, we also need to find the links and build the bridges between the other issues that are out there. So while our mission puts us in a certain parameter, it doesn't prevent us from linking up with people who are speaking out against repression and war at the same time.
While police brutality has dropped off the public consciousness after 9/11, the police killings continue. Since September 11, 140 people have been killed nationwide. Yet, Yip says, the general consciousness post 9/11 is that police officers are heroes who can do no wrong.
Basically, we're looking at a warfare police state. The overall umbrella in which the administration is trying to wage the so-called war on terrorism has somewhat, you know, extended to their lingering agenda towards Iraq. But I think the thing is that either way, they are hell-bent on waging this, you know, uncontrolled war internationally, you know, unilaterally, whatever-wise, and whoever be damned, and particularly the people in the United States be damned. And I think that's one thing we need to also understand, that this the repression that we're experiencing right now, the re-increasing police brutality, the imposition of greater repressive legislation, including the USA Patriot Act, the criminalization of outspoken attorneys like Lynn Stewart. So the question of war and repression go hand in hand.
Police brutality inside America and state-sanctioned violence by America in Afghanistan or Iraq are similar struggles, says Yip.
What we're trying to say is that we don't need to build bridges between among communities under siege so that we can come together as one hand, because that's really, really important in terms of what one recapturing the national debate on the question of police brutality, because since 9/11, the question of the police and the state apparatus have been heightened to the point where police activities are glorified and have been rehabilitated, so that police brutality no longer is even a question where the presidential candidates have to mention.
Juanita Young, mother of Malcolm Ferguson, who was shot by New York City police, had this message for Iraqi mothers.
I say that I feel for their pain, because here their children are innocent to something they had nothing to do with, and the fact that they, again, have no control in what's happening. All I can tell them is that these, that like, say, the president and the vice president and all these people with some kind of power, they have children out there like the rest of us. And the fact that their family is so well protected that they should think about the next person and stop letting these people that come out here and kill our children not be made accountable when you got these cops coming out here standing right in front of the mother and shooting them down and not caring about the mother's pain or feeling, that somebody should have to answer that. And this government should stop letting innocent people have to suffer.
My poor little children, one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, from WBAI in New York City, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
The No Child Left Behind Act of 2001, President George W. Bush's education reform bill, was signed into law on January 8, 2002. By all accounts, it is the most sweeping education reform legislation since 1965, when President Lyndon B. Johnson passed his landmark Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Technically, the new bill is a reauthorization and revision of that 1965 legislation and dramatically increases the role of the federal government in public education for all children in the United States. The legislative tome also contains several amendments that include provisions which allow religious groups and the Boy Scouts of America to use public schools that receive federal funds. And as Dred Scott Keyes reports, another amendment has raised a red flag for civil libertarians, school administrators, and parents.
The United States government imposed a mandate on schools that they release the names, addresses, and phone numbers of high school students to the United States military so that they could use them for recruiting purposes.
That was Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. The Advocate organization is one of a growing number of organizations and individuals responding to a provision in the Act that requires schools to send critical student information, such as names, address, and phone number, whether unlisted or not, to military recruiters and institutions of higher learning. According to government documents, the information is ostensibly needed to expand a child's educational options. Doris Madrinero is the mother of a 15-year-old son who attends the Manhattan Comprehensive Day and Night High School in New York City. She says she was surprised at a recent letter from the school.
It arrived in the mail, and it was sort of out of the blue. I had no awareness, and other parents with whom I have spoken had no awareness of the No Child Left Behind Act 2002 letter, which came along indicating that if you did not want, again, not want your son or daughter's name, address, and contact information to be released to military recruiters or institutions of higher learning, that you were to sign at the bottom and return to the principal's office this form. And it requires an action, otherwise an action will be taken, I suppose. In that way, it might be an unpermission slip, because if you don't respond to it, it's implied, it would seem, that information about your child will be forwarded to military recruiters and schools of higher learning or institutions of higher learning. And I couldn't quite understand what the connection of the military recruiters and institutions of higher learning had to do, and yet we're saying No Child Left Behind is implied in the title. We want everybody.
There's something wrong with this picture.
Donna Lieberman says the method used by the government of having the parents actively opt out by returning a non-consent form is insidious and underhanded.
Because, as we all know, when you receive junk mail, you don't necessarily respond. In fact, when magazines offer you subscriptions, they can't say, unless you say no, you're in for a $50 subscription to a magazine. You have to opt in, right? Well, we're saying that when it comes to the privacy of students' names, addresses, and phone numbers, that parents should be required to opt in to give it to the military, not opt out. But there are cities around the state that we know of that have done it the right way.
One of those school districts that are doing it right is Fairport, a suburb of Rochester, New York. Dr. William Keller is superintendent of Fairport Schools and says he was also caught unawares of the new federal requirements.
We found out that this was part of the No Child Left Behind Act when a military recruiter showed up at our door asking for the list. We had no idea that it was part of the act, and we had to find out what was actually in the No Child Left Behind Act relative to that dictate. Of course, we didn't provide the list without knowing what our legal obligations were. And then when we found out what the law required, we developed this this way of parent notification. And interestingly enough, the military recruiters have been asking for this information way back in the spring. And we got our first bit of guidance from this from the state in a September 24th memo from the deputy commissioner, which we received, by the way, on October 10th. This act makes it a little just as an attempt to get at that those lists and direct market kids and families. I feel very comfortable. At least I feel good that the law has a requirement that parents must give their okay.
That okay, says Keller, was given the chance for parents to opt in.
Meaning that we have to get the paper back in order for us to release the information. So when we get a paper back and it's signed saying that they grant the permission, then we will release the list. Now, it's a little different from an opt-out or somewhat of a laissez-faire policy where we ask simply send out a notice to parents and ask us to send us only an objection if they object to. We feel that it's very important that they grant us permission in order to release these lists because it is something new and we don't want anyone's rights cut short.
The Act says NYCLU's Donna Lieberman can also place families of immigrants in compromising positions.
Their families are particularly vulnerable to the intimidation and the pressure that an unsolicited, unwanted letter from the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines represents. And they should not be subject to that unless they affirmatively ask for it, particularly given the events and the discrimination and hostility and harassment that immigrants from South Asian countries and Arab countries have faced over the past several months.
Both Keller and Lieberman say the provision is costly and place an unfair burden on school districts across the country.
We're living in an era where they're cutting back sports teams, they're cutting back art, they're cutting back music. And the New York City Department of Education is insisting that a first-class letter be sent home at the cost of tens of thousands of dollars. That money, if the schools are going to facilitate military recruiting, that ought to come out of the military budget, not out of precious and scarce education dollars.
Several Congress members, having been contacted by this reporter and who actually voted against the amendment offered by Representative David Vitter from Louisiana, had little idea about the impact of the provision. Again, Fairport, New York School Superintendent William Keller.
When you have a bill as long as the No Child Left Behind bill, who among the 50 legislators in the 50 states, do you think anybody read that? It's too big. And it's so big that I just don't even know if legislative staffs could actually tear it down. Months later, in the field, we're finding out what's actually in the act. And I just don't think that's the way it ought to be. I think people ought to know up front what they're voting on, and they shouldn't vote for anything unless they know what's up front.
Given the current warmongering and saber-rattling by the Bush administration, the provision may act as another front in the anti-war movement. For Imperatives for Peace, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Among the members of Congress who approved the Bush administration's resolution to go to war with Iraq several weeks ago were 27 Democrats in the Senate and 81 in the House of Representatives, despite overwhelming opposition from their constituents. In response, political satirist Michael Moore circulated a petition on the Internet calling for people to pledge never again to vote for any Democrat that voted for the resolution. We spoke earlier today with two people who took that advice to heart. Randall Forsberg is running for Senate as a write-in candidate against John Kerry in Massachusetts. And Dennis Moynihan is running against Representative Dennis Moore in Kansas.
I'm in a district of Kansas where the every vote counts. And I'm this write-in candidacy that I have here in the 3rd District is hopefully going to seriously register on the Democratic Party's radar, and it may very well, if the next 2 weeks pan out, it will give them a strong message. It may cost them the seat. It's guaranteed that a pro-war candidate will win unless I win, given that each of the other candidates has $1.5 million to spend or already spent with prepaid TV ads and so on. But there are existing grassroots networks and other kind of creative ways to get the message out. And I and people who support this candidacy are working on that.
So, well, the majority of power in the Senate is hanging by one vote.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really want to shift that to the Republican camp? I'm speaking to you, Randy, because
right.
you're opposing Senator John Kerry in
right.
Massachusetts.
Well, there is no Republican opponent to Kerry. There is a Libertarian opponent who on the ballot who will get a very small number of votes, we know from past experience. I expect to get more votes than the Libertarian. Although we have only 2 weeks to go, before the election, as of the date when I'm announcing my candidacy, I think it's possible that we will get a very large number of votes, definitely tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, and possibly millions. But there are 6 million people in the state, so maybe I'm overstating it with millions. I'm not sure how many people actually vote normally in a midterm election. But even if it's a very large vote for my write-in candidacy, there are two key points in responding to what you said. The first is I don't think I'm going to win. The second is that I'm a Democrat, and I'm a registered Democrat, and I'm running as a Democrat. So this would not give the Senate to Republicans, and nor will it give the Senate seat from Massachusetts to anyone other than a Democrat.
You think that Senator Kerry will win?
I think that he, because of I don't have such high name recognition, although I have very good name recognition among peace activists and among many progressive people. But there are large numbers of progressive people and even larger numbers of people who are opposed to the war in Iraq, who have heard of Kerry and have not heard of me, and we may not be able to get out enough information to build confidence that I'm actually a serious candidate before the election for people to go with an unknown good candidate over a known less good candidate.
Mm-hmm. So if you don't really expect to win, this is an exercise in making a strong political statement, I take it.
Well, I mean, I think many people who run may not expect to win. I would like to win, and I am doing everything that I can to get the largest possible number of votes. I just don't think it's likely. And I think that the reason for the candidacy is to communicate to John Kerry, who is a presidential, he's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for president in 2004. We all know that. And I think it's important to communicate to him and to the Democratic Party that voting in favor of war is not a good way to become president. On the contrary, it's really moving to the right of not just Massachusetts, but the national electorate. And I think politically was a terrible mistake for Kerry, but certainly as a matter of conscience is terribly wrong. And then as a matter of democracy, the people who urged me and really drafted me to run pointed out that in the week before the vote on the War Powers Resolution, according to his own staff members, Kerry's office got about 20,000 emails, which were overwhelmingly against the resolution, and he voted for it anyway. So he's not representing his constituents. He's doing something which is a mistake from the point of view of U.S. national security, I mean, in permitting this war, as well as, you know, in terms of increasing terrorism. It's a mistake economically, and I think it's a mistake politically. It reflected a terribly bad judgment. And I do think that the he personally and the Democrats, other Democrats who voted in favor of the resolution should be held accountable and realize that they are really heading in the wrong direction.
Dennis Moynihan, now you are running for Congress in the 3rd District of Kansas. You're a write-in candidate against Dennis Moore of Kansas. Do you expect to win?
No, but we're actually in an interesting position here in this district. It's one of the tightest races, as I said, and so I believe we have an opportunity to leverage issues that have national and global significance with a small number of votes. If we can insert our disapproval of the war in Iraq, and another plank of my platform is to oppose something that Dennis Moore and the other Republican contender support, which is these pro-corporate free trade policies, which is a form of economic warfare on people, then we can make a difference in, if not the actual outcome, certainly in the national dialogue that accompanies this election. And the election is a media hook. People will be looking at tight races. Certainly the possibility of a write-in candidacy encouraging people to oppose war, shifting the outcome from a Democrat to a Republican, could have a significant impact on the who controls the House. Imagine if it comes down to just like the Senate, a one seat difference, the Republicans have it, and we could point to the Dennis Moore's support of the unelected president's war against the innocent people of Iraq as the trigger that drove a number of progressive or caring voters away from him.
Write-in candidates Dennis Moynihan, who's opposing Representative Dennis Moore of Kansas, and Randall Forsberg, who's taking on U.S. Senator John Kerry. Daniel Ellsberg, who in 1971 leaked 7,000 pages of classified documents about the war in Vietnam, just wrote a book titled Secrets, a Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. On his book tour, he stopped in Boston, and as he explains to a crowd at the Arlington St. Unitarian Church, he spent most of his time criticizing Massachusetts Senator John Kerry for his vote in favor of Bush's war resolution.
My talk tonight was not much about my book. A little bit in reference, of course, it was about the war. I was being in part quite critical of a local son here. I have a very good blurb, which I was very proud to get, from Senator John Kerry. And I sent the book to him right away. He gave me a very good blurb here. In fact, he used the word courage. And, you know, he's a guy who's had courage in Vietnam, and he's had courage since Vietnam. And I very much appreciated this comment from him, very helpful. And I felt here in this town, what needed saying right now was, write the congresspersons like Barbara Lee and the 133 House members who voted against this war for their appreciation. Your appreciation for what they did, because they'll get a lot of mail on the other side, and they need to be reassured that they haven't lost their future altogether, with you anyway. And I said, and the 23 senators, one Republican, Chafee of Rhode Island, one independent who's truly an independent, Jeffords, and 21 Democrats, including Massachusetts' Edward Kennedy, who voted against this war and against this unconstitutional turning over of the war power given exclusively to Congress by the Constitution for the best of reasons, to keep us out of unnecessary, wrongful wars that are, as Tom Paine said, caused by the pride of kings. And that's why they didn't want a king. That was a monarchical power they didn't want. So I said, on the other hand, also let know, call the offices, write the offices of the Democrats who cover themselves with shame for signing away that power, most of whom knew better and knew what they were doing. And it's so wonderful for me. Well, I wanted to say there's a positive side to this. 23 votes against that in 1964 for Tonkin Gulf won. There was two votes in the Senate. There is a time, then, when courage is simply necessary. And people have courage that they don't know they have till they come up against it. Senator Kerry, I felt I had to say, despite my appreciation for his blurb on this book, I wanted to say tonight in his hometown, I would far rather have had his vote right on this bill, even though it didn't stop the war, than to have his endorsement. I would rather have us not be facing what we're facing, which makes this book so timely, than to have this book at all, obviously. I mean, that goes without saying. Kerry will have other chances to show his courage as a civilian. And he's done it in the past, and I hope he'll do it again. I hope he'll do it again. And when the time comes, after all, he's no different, no worse than the other six major Democratic candidates for president who all found themselves voting against Senator Byrd and against Senator Kennedy, not because they knew something they didn't, not because Dianne Feinstein in my state knew something that her colleague Senator Boxer, who led a fight against this bill, Boxer's on the Intelligence Committee. Feinstein didn't know something that Boxer didn't. Kerry didn't know something that Kennedy didn't. They knew just what Byrd was saying. They knew just what was Kennedy saying. But those people weren't running for president. And they said to themselves, I want to do right by the world as a president, as a candidate. I'll have no chance to do that. They're not evil men. They're not corrupt. They're saying to themselves with some reason, I can't run for president. I, Biden. I, Daschle. I, Hillary Clinton. I, Richard Gephardt. I, John Edwards. I, John Kerry. I can't run for president if I'm faced with a charge, which I know to be untrue, that my vote against this bill is a vote for Osama bin Laden, a charge that I'm weak, that I'm soft on defense, a charge that I am pro-Hussein. They all know that's untrue. They're not worried, but they don't want to be charged with it. It takes a little courage. It's not even clear it took that much this time to be on the right side of this. So Kerry may again. Kerry may be the best candidate we have. I may vote for him in the end. You all may vote for him. He may be the best person. Unfortunately, he missed the challenge. You have to compromise to be president. You have to compromise to be a politician. That's what politics is. But there are times when you shouldn't compromise, and this was not the bill for Kerry or any of the others to compromise on.
Author Daniel Ellsberg, thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, the spiritual teachings of the church President Bush attends.